Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. Continuing with Chapter 7 from Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks, we're now ready for Part 2 of Touching History Squared, Mount Blackburn, 1977. Here we go. Dueling universes. Our first day on the ridge, June 2, was sobering, since all the usual impediments were in place. The snow was too soft, crevasses yawned, the slope was too steep, the exposure was sudden and shocking, and worse, the ridge was continually corniced. Rob and I led and immediately had trouble crossing the bergschrund separating the flight deck from the ridge. But after solving that problem, we started up the ridge, which immediately narrowed to a rasp. When we reached a little summit, I was astonished and dismayed to see that the ridge beyond was ridiculous. Could we possibly be defeated on our first day? With doubts knocking and thoughts swirling, I looked around. There had to be a way. Then, in a bang ice axe on head moment, I saw that the slope below the ridge to the east was not just passable, but easy. Chagrined, Rob and I retreated from our summit to meet the others coming up with loads. We had wasted valuable time, an hour of which we would search for later. When Hinkle heard our story, he looked up at our first fault summit and proclaimed, "Well, that fang is the wisdom tooth. It has given us wisdom, but we do not need it." After easily traversing below the wisdom tooth, we engaged the ridge beyond, that Hinkle dubbed the Ripper. There was no avoiding the Ripper, and Rob and I crept up trying to put ourselves into the picture, but our heads were not yet in climb mode. Looking at all the hazards, I felt a strange malaise tugging at the corners of my mind. How careful can one man be? Back on the flight deck that evening, we had a more animated conversation and solidified our team commitment to this climb. There were five of us, and it made sense for two to lead while three followed with loads. As we had just learned, there needed to be some separation between these two efforts. This separation carried its own hazard, but knowing that the roles were interchangeable, we made a plan. Our two teams would stay in shouting range, and if all was going well, we would yodel. But if anyone needed relief for any reason, they would holler, "Rolades!" The next morning, June 3, Roger and I led back up to our previous high point while the others prepared to follow with light loads. The persistent cornice on my right bothered me, and I reassessed the position of our line of steps. Too far to the right, and we could plunge through the cornice. Too far to the left, and we could trigger a slide that could take us down the other side. The game was to step just to the left of the line where the cornice would break. But where was that line? The stark snow didn't come with pre-painted lines or directions. After two new pitches, we set an anchor so that I could have a belay on a steep step in the ridge. The step looked even more dangerous, and I looked at the pitch with trepidation. When the moment came for me to charge forth with vigor, I plopped into the snow and fell into a deep funk. It is easy to dream, to plan, to pack, to approach, to overcome modest difficulty, but a climb's hard moves can vault you into a new universe. I sat at a tipping point in my mind. This project was obviously going to be longer, harder, and more dangerous than I had visualized. Suddenly, it was too much. I knew that my funk was connected to my Everest failure. I had not yet recovered my crux punch. However, that realization did no good now, since I was poised on the ridge. Roger looked askance at the pitch as well, and asked, "Well, do we holler Rolades?" The question only deepened my failure-fingered funk. My climbs had always been full of an almighty forward momentum, and I was not used to failure or funks. Everest had put some sort of hex on my mind. When Roger looked at me a second time for an answer, I looked at the pitch one more time, then quietly and reluctantly replied, "Yeah, let her rip." Roger sucked a lungful, reared back, and let loose a monstrous rollage. The power of our call for assistance startled me, and flicking snowballs at the abyss, I just stared at our anchor. Roger and I waited while Rob, Barb, and Hinkle approached. When Rob arrived at our precarious stance, I didn't have to explain my new universe. Rob just geared up and led the pitch. With steps and rope in place, the rest of us followed with the loads. As I climbed the mini crux, I spanked my mind, since the pitch was not that hard. On June 4, I abdicated my position in the lead to further refuel my mind. Rob and Roger led above the mini crux and overcame the bigger crux above. On June 5, I pushed my downward pulling universe aside and transitioned to a third universe where I could accept and deal with the original universe. I led above the big crux and reached Fog Flats, where we could pitch our next camp. So far, there had been daily fog on our route, and it did hamper our leading, especially on the harder sections. We assumed that we would climb above it. All we needed was another 1,000 feet. However, as we dropped our loads on Fog Flats at 10,900 feet, the consuming fog concerned us, since we were now 2,000 feet above the flight deck. The weather lowered in the night, but on June 6, we packed up our short-lived base camp on the flight deck, severed the cord to the lowlands, and headed up the ridge to stay. There was not a day to lose, and misbehaving clouds were not a reason to sit around, especially since most of our food was now ahead of us. By the end of the day, we had our two tents pitched on Fog Flats and had retrieved our meager supply of fixed rope and anchors from the ripper below. Finally done with the testy ripper, we really felt ready to climb Blackburn, but did not know that the ridge above us still contained a cosmos of complications. Looking down on the ripper through a feisty fog, I could see a slight color change in the snow, where the newer cornice snow separated from the older ridge snow. Amazingly, I was looking at the normally unseen cornice break line. We could not see this line while we were climbing the ripper, and with a twinge of pride, I saw that our steps were perfectly positioned just onto the solid ridge snow. When fog sealed the view, the lower world disappeared, and I turned back toward the tents. Still low on the mountain, we had used one of our 3 weeks. The next morning, June 7, the clouds were misbehaving badly. The weather wasn't violent, but visibility was near nil. Nevertheless, we suited up and started above camp to find a route. With only a few feet of visibility, I probed upward like a blind man for 500 feet, then came to the lip of a 20-foot-wide crevasse. It extended well beyond my limited visibility in both directions. Stubborn, I plopped near the edge of the crevasse to wait for any shift in the cloud that would allow me to spot a route around the crevasse. After 30 motionless minutes, my teammates were predictably agitated, so I moved along the crevasse to the right, but it got wider. I retreated and moved to the left, but the slope steepened until I realized that I was being foolish. I retreated to my original position, peered into the gloom for another 10 minutes, then ordered a retreat back to the tents. The afternoon slipped by with no improvement, and our already tight schedule felt the sting of a lost day. That evening, we sat glumly recounting our food supply and strategizing. We figured that we had to be ready to move at any moment when there was visibility. When we could see even a little, we would zoom ahead, find and wand a route, and find the next possible campsite. Then we could move our camp up in the fog. We called this the inchworm tactic. Above us, the ridge broadened and steepened into a complex series of ice cliffs and crevasses. Taking full advantage of a clear morning on June 8, Rob and I made an early start to lead ahead with our technical gear, as was now our norm, while Roger, Barb, and Hinkle prepared loads to follow us by a few hours. Rob and I made rapid progress until the route above was blocked by an overhanging ice wall infested with grotesque gargoyles. We traversed 100 yards to our left and spied a steep but smooth slope leading past the difficulty. Feeling strong in the sun, I led up the pitch that we called the zipper. To my surprise, I found hard Alaska blue ice under a few inches of crusty snow. This was a condition that I had found many times before, and I steadily moved up the 600-foot wall. At the top, the angle relented, and I brought Rob up to a comfortable perch. We yodeled our encouragement to our teammates below. After a break, I looked up the route and spotted what I thought was a better place for us to make our cache and possibly even a camp. Impatient, I charged up the easy snow slope. A few seconds later, I was flying free. As I flew into the hidden crevasse, I had enough time to scream at myself, "You idiot! The slack!" I had made a major error in charging ahead without a tight rope behind me, and as my free fall continued, I started to compute just how much slack rope was between me and Rob. It was close to 150 feet. I went poof into some soft snow and stopped. Motionless, I sensed several things. I was not injured. I was in a huge hole perched on a minor patch of snow, and there was more air below me. I had not fallen 150 feet, and there was still much slack in the rope. My hat, while still with me, was over my eyes, blocking my sight. Heart racing, I remained motionless. Seconds ticking like time bombs, I finally dared to make a minimal movement to push my hat back so that I could see. What I saw confirmed my worst fear. I was indeed on a fragile snow hump poised above the biggest crevasse horror that I had ever seen. Hidden from above, the bowels of the crevasse held an acre of air. I could not see the bottom, but a trip there would clearly be my last. What I did see was the slack rope swinging in the void. I remained transfixed in my nearly upside-down position. Rob, who had been finishing his lunch, would eventually figure out that I had disappeared into a crevasse, set an anchor, and come to my aid. Eventually. An impatient move on my part could break my perch, and not just end it for me, but Rob as well. Unable to see behind me, I fingered a far-flung universe and waited. In my trap, I thought of Barb below and regretted bringing her onto this difficult ridge. If I died here, it would be a ridiculous ending for her. After Everest, I should have known that it was too much. I was trying to get back into my Everest saddle, but I felt that she was willing to let Everest go. We had experienced the overtone of life on our Archangel climb, but sequels are rarely as good as passion-pumped originals. From my hole, I could barely see my Everest saddle and was clearly having trouble climbing back toward it. If I survived this one, perhaps I should just let it all go. Just then, I felt and heard a tinkle of snow falling from above. Rob was approaching the lip and about to get his first look at my pitfall. I hoped that he had prepared a good anchor on top, since if he repeated my fall, we would find the bottom together, an even worse ending. Finally, I heard Rob's amazingly calm voice utter what would become a famous remark. "Oh my goodness!" I couldn't see Rob, but replied with considerably more urgency, "Up rope!" Rob is one of the smartest partners that I have ever climbed with, and with no further words necessary, Rob retreated from the lip, and I continued my frozen vigil. My pulse had slowed, but now my mind was racing. If only... After a third infinity, I saw and felt the slack rope going up. After it came tight with authority, I waited a few more moments to make sure that Rob really had me. Finally, I dared to move. The snow on my perch was quite soft, and righting myself required many careful movements. But of course, my background mind had been rehearsing these moves. Pulling on the tight rope for aid, I came around to a belly flop position where I could at last fully see what was behind me. Ignoring the drop below me, I looked up. The crevasse directly above me narrowed in a double overhang. Not good. I had fallen close to 100 feet and had a lot to think about. The crevasse behind me was narrower and had merely vertical walls, but the bottom of it was 60 feet above me. My snow perch was something of a ramp and offered some hope, so keeping my weight dispersed, I started swimming up it. The snow behind me swooshed into nothingness. As I inched up, I could feel Rob up-roping with my every move, and this was the most reassuring tug that I had ever felt. Inch up, inch up, inch up. Careful! The whole ramp could go. Inch up, up, up. Rising to the occasion, I quickly computed moves that I had never made before, then made them. Throughout my swim, I was careful to retain command of my ice axe. The upper crevasse approached, and hope surged when I saw that a traverse would take me to a small shelf below the upper challenge. I dispatched the traverse, then looked up at my future. I was still 40 feet below the lip. The semi-shelf below the upper walls was not flat, and I continued my rightward traverse until the down mountain wall was less than vertical. I was now to the right of the rope and my plunge hole, but I could climb the wall above me. My ice axe now came into full play, and I whacked and cramponed up the wall with a startling vigor. As I climbed, the rope angle increased. Step left, whack! Step left, whack! Clear snow above, whack! Whack! Clear snow, pull through into light and life. I was out! With Rob still up roping, I pulled well clear of the lip, then lay panting in the snow while we figured out what to say to each other. The best I could come up with was, indeed, oh my goodness. I retreated to Rob's stance and saw that he had set up quite a good anchor and belay system. My fall had obviously been nearly trip-ending or worse, but as climbers often do, we only chatted about the technical details. Barb didn't hear the story until we were back in camp and only got a watered-down version, but she knew. When Roger heard the story of my crevasse fall, he went silent for a moment, then, from memory, launched into a recitation of the long Robert Service poem, The Spell of the Yukon. I wanted the gold, and I sought it. I scrabbled and mucked like a slave. Was it famine or scurvy? I fought it. I hurled my youth into a grave. I wanted the gold, and I got it. Came out with a fortune last fall. Yet somehow life's not what I thought it, and somehow the gold isn't all. No, there's the land. Have you seen it? It's the cussedest land that I know. From the big dizzy mountains that screen it to the deep death-like valleys below. Some say God was tired when he made it. Some say it was a fine land to shun. Maybe, but there's some as would trade it for no land on earth, and I'm one. You come to get rich, damn good reason. You feel like an exile at first. You hate it like hell for a season. Then you are worse than the worst. It grips you like some kinds of sinning. It twists you from foe to a friend. It seems it's been since the beginning. It seems it will be to the end. I've stood in some mighty-mouthed hollow that's plumb full of hush to the brim. I've watched the big husky sun wallow and crimson and gold and grow dim, till the moon set the pearly peaks gleaming, and the stars tumbled out neck and crop. And I thought that I surely was dreaming, with the peace o' the world piled on top. The summer no sweeter was ever, the sunshiny woods all a-thrill, the grayling a-leap in the river, the bighorn asleep on the hill, the strong life that never knows harness, the wilds where the caribou call, the freshness, the freedom, the farness. Oh God, how I'm stuck on it all! The winter, the brightness that blinds you, the white land locked tight as a drum, the cold fear that follows and finds you, the silence that bludgeons you dumb, the snows that are older than history, the woods where the weird shadows slant, the stillness, the moonlight, the mystery. I've bade 'em goodbye, but I can't. There's a land where the mountains are nameless, and the rivers all run God knows where. There are lives that are erring and aimless, and deaths that just hang by a hair. There are hardships that nobody reckons, there are valleys unpeopled and still. There's a land, oh, it beckons and beckons, and I want to go back, and I will. They're making my money diminish. I'm sick of the taste of champagne. Thank God, when I'm skinned to a finish, I'll pike to the Yukon again. I'll fight, and you bet it's no sham fight. It's hell, but I've been there before, and it's better than this by a damn sight. So, for me, it's the Yukon once more. There's gold, and it's hunting and haunting. It's luring me on as of old. Yet it isn't the gold that I'm wanting, so much as just finding the gold. It's a great, big, broad land way up yonder. It's the forest where silence has lease. It's the beauty that thrills me with wonder. It's the stillness that fills me with peace. After this somber view of our reality, we all sat silently. Finally, summarizing my pondering, I said, "There are many reasons that it's called the Great Land, but nothing is perfect. Let's get some sleep." Double Cornice. On June 9, we used our inchworm tactic, moved camp up to the base of the zipper, and retrieved everything from below. The tactic eliminated the need to maintain a route over a long distance, when the wind could easily fill in our hard-won steps. However, we knew that the double cornice waited for us up there somewhere, and that there would be significant stretches of the route where it would not be feasible to camp. We inched forward to find out. On June 10, Hinkle and Roger led above the zipper into our still-present fog, but it was a Rolaids morning. Rob and I took over and led a steep ice pitch. I cut huge bucket steps for the following load carriers, but 5'3" Barb still complained that my steps were 4 feet apart. Having consumed their Rolaids, Roger and Hinkle yodeled and led up into the evening clear-off until a huge crevasse stopped them just one pitch below the ridge above that we assumed held the double cornice. The day had yielded good efforts, and our teamwork was paying dividends. June 11 found me struggling to find a route around the crevasse that had stopped Roger and Hinkle the evening before. I spent 2 hours crafting a route around the obstacle. Finally, above the maw, I led up a steep slope in yet another fog, hoping to reach the double cornice ridge. There was no wind. Touching the texture of the snow, I felt forward for clues. If I was walking up onto a cornice, I needed to know about it before I went too far. Leading in the fog had turned my senses to nature's more subtle messages, and in spite of my plunge, I now felt at peace with my exposed position. I post-holed up another 100 feet, but there was no change in the snow or air. A few steps later, I sensed it before I felt it, and went into full alert. pushed my hat back to fully expose my ears, then rocked my head from side to side to better detect any shift in the air. I took one mitten off and crept forward for three more steps, testing for any change in the snow with my bare hand. Obeying some celestial command, I stopped. Raising my head, I felt a faint waft of air moving toward me. I was near the ridge, and it would certainly be corniced. Poised, I waited for further clues. After a minute, the waft intensified and the gloom brightened. It might clear, so I held my position. The waft became a breeze, the fog swirled, and I spotted a rounded stretch of ridge to my left. After hollering my intention to my companions, waiting patiently below, I moved left onto the bulge. It was wide enough for the tents and seemed secure, so I brought my teammates up. As we carefully probed our new stance, we waited for the fog to reveal our future. For the first time on the trip, I felt the tingle of high Alaska. We were about to engage the upper mountain. While we debated the option of digging a snow cave instead of pitching the tents, the fog swirled higher and our conversation stopped. Peering up the ridge, we finally saw it. Emerging from its foggy cocoon, the double cornice leered at us like a two-headed horror. It was frightening but beautiful at the same time. At first glance, we had no idea how to traverse it and just stared in silence. A cornice forms when the prevailing wind blows snow over a ridge into a roll hanging over the lee slope. But how could the wind blow from both directions with sufficient force to make two cornices, one in each direction? Wouldn't one wind prevail and blunt the other? Puzzled, we gazed at this natural wonder. The double cornice had been my original spark for this trip. Now here I was staring at it. One of my old adages tugged at me. Carefully consider where your primal urges are leading you. However, on closer inspection, it did not look difficult to traverse through the crease between the cornices. We did wonder if one or both might fall with our weight on it, but was what we couldn't see that bothered me more. I imagined some huge crack or split in the ridge that would completely stop us. To answer this important question, Rob and I led toward the double cornice. But the approach across the top of a steep slope to the right quickly consumed me. The right slope had already produced a large slab avalanche, leaving a 2-foot crown face just a few feet from the small cornice on my left. Treading the needle, I walked just above the crown face, using my ice axe in the cornice snow to my left. When I extracted my axe from one hole, I peered through the hole to the glacier thousands of feet below. The cornice snow to my left was essentially useless. I was inches from walking on air. Several nervous but perfectly placed steps later, I reached better snow. After Rob reached the solid snow, we started the sacred steps toward the crease between the two cornices. Of course, the brake lines of the two cornices overlapped. In the crease, we could fall either way. I imagined that I weighed nothing and walked into the crease. With the snow first higher on my left, then higher on my right, my passage was ephemeral. The snow was solid, and it seemed like the two cornices somehow supported each other in a codependent union. My fears relaxed as I saw that the slope on the far side was smooth, and that the ridge beyond continued in a more normal single cornice countenance. Rob and I retreated to the others, who were hard at work on a snow cave for our new cornice camp. When it cleared, we saw just how exposed cornice camp was, and we decided to dig a snow cave there for better protection from any violent storms. Since the site was flat, it took some engineering to get a cave large enough for all five of us, but after a big effort, we had our hole. While we worked, we paused every few moments to ponder the double cornice. After working late, we retreated to Zipper Camp and had supper at midnight. On June 12, still trying to outclimb the fog and lusting for the upper mountain, we brushed aside fear and fatigue, packed up zipper camp, and brought everything up to our new cornice camp at 13,100 feet. On the way up, I had a view down to the Kuskalana Glacier. The still-shrouded glacier looked dark, dank, and far away, but up here it was light and bright. I also noticed that the glacier had changed considerably. Crevasses had opened, the rubble was higher, and it looked like an unpleasant, even impassable place. We were now more than halfway up the ridge, and I vowed and knew that retreat was not an option. We were completely committed to the traverse, but the most difficult climbing was still above us. We still had to get across the double cornice. Beyond the double cornice rose a significant summit on the ridge. The map gave it an elevation of 14,260 feet. While in cornice camp, Hinkle suddenly blurted out, "We should call that peak the Snave." Puzzled, I replied, "Huh?" Hinkle continued, "Thought you'd never ask. The Colorado 14er with an elevation closest to 14,260 feet is Mount Evans at 14,264. Evans spelled backwards is Snave." Chortling, I replied, "Brilliant! Snave it is." In cornice camp, we were suspended between two worlds. We were completely cut off from the lower world, but would somehow have to return there. Our return depended on traversing terrain in the higher world that we did not yet know or understand. Both calm and searing, it was a prime time. We were exhilarated since we knew that the ridge ahead of us was passable, even easy. The Snave looked steep and exciting, but within our grasp, and beyond the Snave we could start thinking about our summit push. To maximize our day's efforts, Rob and I led ahead toward the Snave while the other three worked on cornice camp. Rob and I moved back across the double cornice, traversed the ridge beyond, and led up the curvaceous ridge toward the top of the Snave. Exposed, steep, and pure, it was Alaska climbing at its best. Rob and I took turns leading, and like all things Alaska, it was steeper, harder, and more complicated than it had appeared from below. Approaching the Snave summit, the ridge was badly corniced to the left, and the right slope that we had to climb to avoid the cornice was inclined at a vertiginous 70 degrees. The cornice brake line, so neatly drawn in the textbook, was nowhere to be seen. We fixed a line to a stance just 65 feet below the summit, then, tired, we elected to save the last lead for another effort and retreated to cornice camp, reaching our cozy cave at midnight. On Monday, June 13, I crawled out of the tent to find an all-consuming fog and swirling snow. I realized that we had now used 2 of our 3 weeks. I needed to be back at my desk in 1 week, but just as I could not beam myself to the top of Everest, I could not beam myself back to my desk. With a smirk, I realized that, smart as he was, my boss could not beam me back to my desk either. Today was the great day when we wanted to inch our camp above the Snave and prepare for our summit push. However, before we could focus on that, we had to deal with the fact that the fog had turned into a whiteout. The snow was not just swirling, but dumping down, and our cornice camp snow cave was collapsing. Indeed, never mind my boss, carefully consider where your primal urges lead you. Realizing that we had to spend at least one more night in cornice camp, we reluctantly collapsed our cave and pitched one of our tents in the resulting crater, since there was no other safe place to put a tent. This was a tricky transition, since our gear was exposed during the transfer. We were now up against more than the calendar, and Rob and I prepared to climb late in the day when we hoped for a sufficient clearing. It was vital that we complete the route to the top of the Snave. When the whiteout relented back to a mere fog, Rob and I left camp at 5 p.m. and recreated our now familiar steps over the double cornice, the ridge beyond, and up the Snaves' curvaceous ridge. During our tenure on this ridge, both Rob and I had become tuned to many of nature's deeper rhythms, and in particular to the location of the Cornice brake line. Reaching our previous high point, I clipped into our still solid anchor and belayed Rob as he led the summit pitch. As he punched steps across and up the steep right slope, I let him have his nose for the invisible brake line and said nothing. Occasionally pausing to breathe and assess, he climbed steadily toward the Snave summit. Finally, disappearing from my sight, after half an hour I heard a sturdy, "On belay! Climb!" Seconding the pitch, I was impressed at how steep it was. When a snow slope steepness reaches 70 degrees and your feet sink in more than a foot, you can barely move your arms without pushing yourself out, and the slope feels vertical. Inching up, I was impressed with Rob's prowess and did my best to improve the steps for the others. Halfway up, I paused to have a full look at my exposed position. Pondering the air to my right and the Cornice to my left, I wondered just where the brake line was. I hollered the classic line up to Rob, "Have you got me?" He replied instantly, "Yes, you are secure." I took another look at the slope of the Cornice to my left. It rose well beyond my sight level and appeared solid. I reached up with my ice axe and tapped the slope as gently as a newborn baby's burp. It disappeared. Without a sound, the entire Cornice was simply gone. I had been standing on a 70-degree slope, and poof, I was standing on a knife-edge ridge, looking down a 70-degree slope on the other side of the mountain. Rob had placed his steps perfectly. I watched the crumbling Cornice disappear into the abyss, then finished the pitch. Never mind Mount Evans, we had climbed the Snave. As climbers do, I just congratulated Rob with a simple, "Good lead!" Then we turned our attention to the descent off the Snave's north face. Tantalizing, we could see a broad saddle beyond, but the slope leading to it fell away into steepness, and worse, it held a barrier crevasse. As climbers do, we said nothing. It was obvious that we still had major work to do. With the clock again marching toward midnight and our energy and light fading, Rob and I returned to Cornice Camp. After carefully securing our gear, all five of us crammed into the single tent. During our post-midnight supper, we planned for me and Rob to carry loads to the top of the Snave, then somehow force a route down to the saddle beyond. Roger, Barb, and Hinkle would break camp, then follow with loads. Rob and I would then return over the Snave to Cornice Camp for the last loads, and if all went well, we could be camped beyond the Snave by day's end, or at least the day after that. We all realized that this was a crux effort. All we needed was some sleep and less than ridiculous weather. Our bodies needed rest, but the weather on June 14 had other ideas. It was fine. We prepared for our task with care-ridden enthusiasm. Our midnight suppers had pushed our daily cycle beyond 24 hours, and it was 12:30 p.m. before we started. The lead down the Snave's north face was as tricky as anticipated, and it was 6 p.m. before we had the first loads into the saddle. With our camp still behind us, we kept working. Climbed back over the Snave to Cornice Camp, ate some cold ham, finished breaking camp, and started back for the Snave at 9 p.m. In a cold night wind, Hinkle and I pitched both tents on the spacious 13,850-foot saddle, which Hinkle immediately dubbed the rest home. Barb dove in and started supper, while Hinkle and I climbed back to the Snave summit for a last load. Roger and Rob finished cleaning the route behind us, and setting a new record, we finally collapsed at 3 a.m. After the 410-foot descent from the top of the Snave, we were only 750 feet higher than Cornice Camp, but the traverse of the double Cornice and Snave was obviously a major advance in our program. Now we could think about sleep and the summit. Stay tuned for the conclusion of this exciting ascent. History Squared, Mount Blackburn, 1977.